self-consciously over my milk-spattered t-shirt. I hadn't found a hair clip either.
You look like trailer trash. I wonder why that is.
Trammell was hanging out with Aunt Marnie in my head. But Brother Gilbo only smiled and waved off my apology. A strange sense of comfort washed over me. Something about Joe Gilbo made me feel like everything would be all right. For a short man, he was surprisingly quick. He moved fast and talked fast. Within a few minutes, he'd commented that it was a nice walk through the stable yard in the morning mist, so he really didn't mind coming over. He told me he remembered visiting the Outer Banks on vacation years ago when there were horses there, asked me what brought the kids and me to Hatteras, and given me some instructions for cleaning out Ayala's house. Throw away the trash, anything perishable, and stuff that might attract bugs and mice.
We'll get to decision about everything else after the paperwork settled with the house,
he added, and I felt a pinprick of worry. I started to ask about the unsettled paperwork, but then I thought, why rock the boat? Brother Gilbo seemed to know what he was doing.
Can't offer you any money for the job right off, but you got the cottage and all the paid bills. I get a chance. I see can I come up with a few dollars out of the discretionary fund without having to pass around church council. But just keep your work quiet over here till everything's settled with the house.
That was the second time he'd said it. Settled with the house. This time it rang in the corner of my mind like a smoke alarm detecting a fire not far away. I glanced at the cottage and saw the one-eared cat sleeping happily on the windowsill in the front room. Luckily, there were several keys on that ring Brother Gilbo was holding. Hopefully, one of them opened the cottage. Okay, I answered as a breeze wafted by, rustling a few loose leaves from the trees and raining them silently down around us. One landed on Brother Gilbo's head, but he didn't seem to notice as he handed me the keys and reminded me again to clean out all the perishables. I was welcome to keep whatever food I thought I could use. If I needed any cleaning supplies today, I could get them at Binks Village Market and charge them to the church account. As soon as he had the chance, Brother Gilbo would drop off some cash I could use to buy supplies at the Food Lion or Burr's Market, where there was more selection.
No telling what's in the kitchen there.
He motioned toward the house.
Last year or two, Iola had to worry somebody try to move her into an old folks' home, so she stopped having anyone pass through the front door. She didn't mean to make nobody the miser. But she wanted to be in her house when the death angel come to call. Guess she got her way.
A heebie-jeebie ran over my body. I didn't want Brother Gilbo to think I couldn't do the job, but the less I heard about Iola and the death angel, the better. Working alone in that house would be bad enough without remembering that someone had just died there. Brother Gilbo slid a business card from his shirt pocket and handed it to me. It had his name on it, but it was for a Zydeco band, not for the church. Underneath the name, the card read, As Seen in Remy's Bayou. Even I had watched the movie Remy's Bayou.
My other job, when I'm not doing the worship music over to Fairhope Fellowship. Only Louisiana-bred Zydeco band on the banks.
He told me and winked.
There's the number to my cell phone. You got any question, you call me up, okay?
Okay. The keys felt weighty in my hand, but I tried to make it look like I didn't have a worry in the world. I'd managed to successfully plot an escape from the well-guarded lair of Trammell Clark. How bad could one strangely creepy house be? I'm sure I can handle it. Brother Gilbo gave me an enthusiastic nod, and we parted ways. Standing alone in Iola Poole's front yard, I gazed up at the house with its wraparound veranda and intricate railings. Ribbons of peeling paint and crumbling plaster shivered in the breeze like bridal veils, mimicking the uneasy quiver in my stomach. There was no sense putting it off. As soon as I got the cat out of the cottage, grabbed a little breakfast, and put on some dry clothes, I'd have to get started. Whatever was inside that house, it wasn't going anywhere. And in some strange way, I felt that the place was holding its breath. Every nail, board, and batten watching through time-weathered eyes, just waiting for me to come inside. Whether it was stalking me or inviting me, I had absolutely no idea. Chapter 4. In the fourth grade, a girl named Isha asked me home with her after school. I went, even though I knew Aunt Marnie would have a fit if she found out. It wasn't like any of the other kids were going to invite me over, not with the reputation my parents had. They'd just been through another humdinger of a breakup. This one got hot enough to include dishes flying and the police showing up. CPS had dumped Gina and me with my father's sister in Texas again, and Aunt Marnie had made it clear that this was the last time she was taking us. Having us around my father's old hometown was an embarrassment to her. And even at just 10 years old, I could see why. It's never good to be in a place where your daddy's bad deeds walk through every door before you can even get there. Gina wasn't helping matters. At 12, tall and blonde, she looked 16 and was already a whole lot like Mama and Daddy. Isha's mother was from Sierra Leone, black as the ace of spades, as my father would have not so nicely put it. Isha's daddy was a local boy who'd gone all the way to Africa to oversee production in bauxite and platinum mines. They lived on a corner lot in a big blue house with antique rose bushes outside and all the things I'd always wanted inside. There were sweet rolls, milk, and a smiling mama waiting in the kitchen when we walked in. When Isha's daddy came home, he swept his daughter up like they hadn't been together in a month. I just stood there watching from the upstairs hallway with my arms wrapped awkwardly over the princess clothes we'd made from safety pins and old bedsheets. "And who's this?" her father asked, smiling. He had kind eyes, soft and warm and friendly. Isha introduced me as Princess Tandanaho the Brave. When I snaked out my hand, trying to be at my best manners, he bowed low and pretended to kiss my fingers the way Robin Hood did with Maid Marian. His lips never touched my skin, but I jerked my hand back anyway. After a stint in emergency foster care, I'd learned a few things about being too friendly with men I didn't know. Isha's father just smiled and said, "Well, welcome to our kingdom, Princess Tandanaho the Brave." And I felt welcome, as if the air in their home were so fresh and so sweet I couldn't get enough of it. The name and the memory came back to me as I let myself into Iola Ann Poole's house and made my way to the kitchen. "Tandanaho the Brave," I whispered, chuckling at the echo off Iola's high ceilings. It felt good to laugh after almost an hour of chasing the one-eared cat around the cottage. I now fully understood the saying about herding cats. That scabby old thing was not only wily and ugly, he was as mean as an acre of alligators. There was a scent in Iola's kitchen that reminded me of the temporary realm of Tandanaho the Brave. Cinnamon. Or ginger. Maybe both. A pumpkin pie smell, like the sweet rolls Isha's mother made. Despite the clutter of storage boxes and canned food around the edges of Iola's kitchen, it smelled like she'd just been there, baking a pie. The effect was unsettling. I had the urge to walk through the house, ensure that she was really gone. The place didn't seem empty, and I felt like a house guest who'd breezed in without taking time for all the proper niceties. It wasn't a sense of being unwelcome, exactly. More like I should be acknowledging something that I hadn't yet, as if the house were one big question and the answer had nothing to do with cleaning the food out of the kitchen. As if the place wanted something from me. Silly, of course. Houses don't want or think or wonder. They don't bake pumpkin pies when no one's home. They don't love or hate or hope. They just are. They don't know anything. Yet this house was telling a story, even now. Iola's story. She'd eaten something on a blue-rimmed china luncheon plate for her last meal, washed the dish, and set it in the draining rack with a single fork and a stoneware coffee mug. The cup had a faded pink heart on the front, printed with the words, "Love is knowing you love me." Next to the heart stood a sunbonneted Holly Hobby girl in outdated shades of brown and harvest gold. The companions to the blue-rimmed plate waited in a neat stack behind glass, their golden edges glinting in the morning light. The cabinet hinges complained as I opened the door and stood on my toes to run a finger across the shelf, parting the dust. When I lifted one of the matching teacups, a perfect circle of clean space appeared. No one had used these in a while. Was that her routine every day? To drink her coffee in the faded Holly Hobby mug, then wash it and leave it to drain? Was the mug her favorite? Had someone given it to her a long time ago? Someone she loved? Where was that someone now? The buzzer on the oven sounded, and I jumped at least a foot before crossing the kitchen to turn the little white pointer firmly to the off position. My fingers were trembling when I pulled my hand away. So much for Tandanaho the Brave. I was shaking like a poodle being hauled in for annual vaccinations. "Okay, listen, the food needs to be cleaned out of this kitchen because there's nobody here to eat it." I braced my hands on my hips and looked around the room. No one could hear me. But somehow it seemed right to acknowledge the fact that this house had an owner and she hadn't been gone very long. "Brother Gilbo sent me. Someone's got to sort out this mess before the mice take over. I know about mice, believe me. I lived in some ragtag places growing up. One cat isn't going to cut it with all this food sitting around. The cat was as strange as everything else about this house. A puzzle I couldn't put together, no matter how hard I tried. He had me verhoodled, to put it in Pap-Pap's words. I could not, for the life of me, figure out how he came and went from the house, but he did. At night, I'd see him sitting in the turret window. Same black tomcat with eerie gold-colored eyes and half of one ear missing. Just sitting there, still as a stone, staring over the treetops toward the marina and Pamlico Sound, a faint glow casting out from behind him. Someone must have left a lamp on after they took Iola's body away. The next day, the cat would be sitting on the roof of the stable, or prowling the irises in the flower bed, or cautiously sniffing around our porch to see if JT had left anything. There was definitely no cat door in this house. I'd looked more than once in the past week. How to explain an animal seemingly walking through walls, I had no idea. Now the pumpkin pie smell was a mystery, too. I tried to put it out of my mind as I moved around the kitchen and the adjoining washroom, gathering up cleaning supplies, some of which were so ancient that the containers had rotted through. Upstairs, something fell off a table or a shelf and hit the floor above the kitchen. I jumped again, slapping a hand over my collarbone. "I know that's you up there." After a run-in at the cottage, the cat was probably messing with me on purpose. "Stop knocking her things over. Iola wouldn't like it, I'll bet." Blood prickled into my cheeks, and the next thing I knew, I was laughing at myself. Talking to a cat? Really? Time to get to work. I went looking for trash bags and came up with enough to get started for a while. There was an envelope on the counter with $50 inside. I folded it and tucked it into my back pocket. I'd have to go get more bags soon, at least. Brother Gilbo must have stopped back by the big house and left a few bucks for supplies while I was over at the cottage changing clothes and chasing the cat around. All the better, because I wasn't nuts about the idea of charging expenses at Binks Market. Binks was information central around Fairhope, and I was trying hard to stay off the local grapevine. A sliver of temptation needled me as I made a shopping list in my mind. You could add a few extra things to the supply list, then return them and get the money back. Nobody would know the difference. I shook the plan off as soon as it found a voice. I'd been listening to Trammell's form of logic too long. That kind of thinking oversaw the operations of dozens of medical and dental clinics that performed unnecessary procedures on Medicaid kids, then built the system for millions of dollars. I was married to Trammell by the time I'd started to really understand what paid for the massive house, the acres of white-fenced pasture land, the horse barns, the staff, the guard at the front gate, the upscale social engagements where women with the right pedigrees made snooty comments to let me know I was good enough to hire as a rider for horses worth hundreds of thousands, but not good enough to marry into their circle. If they had any idea where Trammell's money came from, they looked the other way. For far too long, I had also. You'll make a lot of excuses for yourself while you're letting your life tumble down a well. It's not until you hit bottom that you see what a deep hole you're in. Okay, trash. I pulled a hefty bag off the roll and snapped it open, but what I really needed was a flamethrower. What was Iola waiting for here? The apocalypse? An old woman living alone couldn't possibly eat all this food, not in 10 years. And on top of that, there was a box of groceries on the counter that looked recent. A delivery from Binks Market, judging by the yellow ticket. $80 worth of groceries the day before she died. I thought about the way I'd found her, there in the bed. Peaceful, as if she'd known her time was coming. Maybe she hadn't. Why else would she have ordered groceries? Still, as mercenary as it sounded, the food would be nice for the kids and me to have. There were even some mini moon pies, JT's favorite. As I went back to work, bells jingled somewhere in the house, the sound high and light, barely audible, but it was there. Stop that, or I'll haul you off to the pound, the dog pound. If that cat didn't quit, I was going to tell Ross to bring his live trap after all, seriously. Outside, the church chimes rang, adding bass to the melody. The music drowned out the cat, and I started sorting through the box of groceries on the counter, counting the church bells as they sounded and faded. 11. The old clock on the kitchen wall was fast. I stopped to adjust the hands. I wasn't sure why. Mice had been in the box on the counter. Bits of pasta and cereal lined the bottom, and a multicolored confetti of chewed-up packaging decorated the food containers inside. It was as good a place to begin as any. Might as well tackle the most recent stuff first and work my way down. After the church bells quieted, there was no more noise in the house. The cat had settled in somewhere. I finished one box and moved on to another, sorting out ruined food, checking expiration dates, saving things the kids and I could use. It felt good to be working, to be moving in some direction after weeks of basically just scrambling to survive. Compared to wondering if you'll have a roof over your head, boxes full of nibbled-on cornflakes and black mouse droppings mixed with white rice don't seem like a problem at all. The job here was much bigger than I'd thought, though. I wondered if Brother Gilbo had any idea. After an hour and a half of hard work, almost everything still looked the same. I'd filled 4 bags and packed a big box of food to take to the cottage, but I'd barely made a dent in Iola's mess. In the pantry, a mouse scampered over the cans and cans and cans of food that flowed onto the kitchen's black and white hexagon-shaped tiles, a sort of card castle gone wrong. I counted the wax paper rolls stacked beside the cans. 32. Some of them were so old that the boxes looked like they belonged in an antique mall. Who knew what was in this house that might be valuable to the right people? I had the temptation to explore the place and see what I could find. Nobody would even know the difference. The idea slid up my arm like the sleeve of an Angora sweater, soft and pleasing at first, then itchy, uncomfortable. Unlocking the window over the kitchen sink, I let in a spray of cool spring air and thought of that one perfect summer on Hatteras. The scents outside were the scents of that summer. The air of that 12-year-old girl who walked in Rodanthe, hand in hand with her grandfather. You know things about yourself when you're 12. Before your body changes, your hormones surge, and in the space of 6 months, the whole world seems to be looking at you differently. That summer on Hatteras, I knew I was made for something good. I knew the world was limitless. I knew that in spite of all my parents' problems and the things they said to me, 2 people in this world thought I was something special. Meemaw was sure I had the prettiest blue eyes and long brown hair she'd ever seen, and Pap-Pap had always liked the fact that whenever we visited, I went with him to his job inspecting properties for the insurance company instead of running around like Gina. I liked learning about how to repair houses after a storm and hearing Pap-Pap's stories of the old days in the Outer Banks and the Tidewater region of North Carolina. Stories about the people I came from, sailors and shrimpers and pioneers. Courageous people. I loved the story of the lost colonists who'd been deposited on the Outer Banks years before the Pilgrims landed on Plymouth Rock. Unlike the Pilgrims, the lost colonists had vanished, no sign of them remaining when their ship had returned again with supplies. When Pap-Pap told me that story, the mystery of it ran over me in delicious shivers. Maybe it wasn't too late for me to dig around and find some piece of that summer girl who still believed the honey-sweet things Meemaw and Pap-Pap said about her. Maybe there was a bit of her left here on Hatteras Island. Maybe there was a bit of her left inside me. What do you think, Iola? I snatched the last trash bag out of the box and popped it open, letting it drift through the light like a filmy white parachute. It crackled softly, its mouth lapping up swirls of dust as I started toward a tower of newspapers with 2 leaking boxes of instant oatmeal atop. Is it too late? Too much water under the bridge? It's too late for this oatmeal, that's for... I heard water running upstairs and tipped my head back, tracking the sound through the pipes. Okay. Cats don't turn on the water. Someone was in this house. Maybe Iola had a roommate nobody knew about, a recluse or a mentally handicapped child who was afraid to come out. Maybe someone really had broken in here last week and Iola's death wasn't an accident after all. Maybe there were secret passageways within the walls, concealed rooms. Perhaps someone was still hiding in them. A rush of crazy possibilities whirled in my mind. The stories fleshing out over the bones in ways that almost seemed to make sense. Slipping a hand into the pantry, I wrapped my fingers around the closest thing that felt like a weapon and came out with a wooden-handled feather duster. A lot of good that would do me. I could tickle the intruder to death. I tossed it aside and rummaged through the pantry mess, finally ending up with a wooden rolling pin and a can of wasp spray. The mental picture was distractingly funny as I started down the hall, cringing each time the floorboards creaked underfoot. Overhead, the sound of water was so clear it seemed like liquid would surely push through the ceiling any moment. I envisioned one of those spreading, seeping stains people see in horror movies, One that starts faint and clear, then darkens into blood or a black ooze, slowly feeding a tangle of clutching vines that sprout snake-like from the plaster. Grab the unsuspecting woman who's been hired to clean out the house and drag her into the wall where the plaster quickly closes up and goes back to normal, swallowing her whole. Maybe there was a reason Brother Gilbo hadn't hired someone he already knew for this job. Maybe he wanted someone expendable. A nervous laugh bubbled up, and I didn't know whether to surrender to it or swallow it. If there was someone upstairs, he or she already knew I was here, and clearly did not want to be found by me. My stomach squeezed into a pulsating knot the size of a walnut, and I considered making a run for the front door as I passed by the piano room again. The woman in the portrait seemed to be watching me, her tumble of strawberry blonde hair shifting in the light, her green eyes curious. That wasn't Iola in the picture. Iola's skin was darker, more of a buttery olive color. The woman in the portrait had skin as pale and smooth as the china cups in the kitchen. Maybe there had been two old women living here, cousins or sisters, but for some unknown reason, one of them hadn't been out of the house in so long that everyone had forgotten her. Maybe she'd kept herself hidden during all the commotion when Iola died. Maybe she was the one who'd been letting the cat in and out and turning on the lamps at night. If I had to believe the house wasn't empty right now, I like that scenario better. A helpless old woman. Someone frail and weak. Someone who would be intimidated by a 5-foot-4-inch house cleaner with a rolling pin and a can of wasp spray. Each stair creaked as I made my way up, stepping, then listening, then stepping again. I took the final 3 stairs right in a row, going for the rush tactic, then stopping in the hallway, swiveling both ways, pointing the wasp spray ahead of me, NYPD style. The hallway was empty, deep and shadow-filled, quiet, not a sound except for the running water. The doors to other rooms hung ajar, just as they had been on the day I'd found Iola's body. But the door to the blue room was closed. Either the men had shut it after they'd taken her out, or it had closed on its own. Or someone had closed it since. I moved toward the sound of the water, pointing the wasp spray as I went, my finger trembling on the trigger, the rolling pin wavering above my shoulder. If someone came at me, I was going to start spraying and swatting without asking questions. I peeked into doorways as I passed. The dark walnut floors in the rooms were dusty, and even in the hallway, a thin layer of silt had started to settle over the random pattern of tracks left behind by the men who'd come for Iola's body. There was no evidence that anyone had been moving around up here since then. That wasn't as comforting as it might have been. It brought up the question of who could possibly turn on the water in the upstairs bathroom without leaving footprints in the dust. Maybe the faucet was old and it just sort of slipped on by itself? The door was open only an inch or two. I hiked up the rolling pin, readied the wasp spray. The humor of that vanished like a whiff of smoke as I moved closer. Nothing was left but a wild pulse thrumming in my ears and the rush of the quick, shallow breathing, my lungs refusing anything more than tiny puffs of air. "Who's in there? Whoever you are, get out here. You're not supposed to be in this..." The door pulled back slowly, and I froze, the blood draining from my face, seeping downward through my body, leaking through the soles of my feet, pooling on the floor and leaching through, my heart wrapped in an empty shell. Everything in me was screaming, "Run!" But I couldn't move. Beyond the door, a slice of the bathroom came into view. White pedestal sink. Water running from an ornate brass faucet, a claw-footed tub with green glass orbs clutched in the brass talons. A leaded glass window. No one standing in the doorway, even now that it was almost halfway open. No one. A whisper of movement slid past the baseboard. I forced my gaze downward, an inch, and then another, another, until finally I could see. Not a shadow. The cat. A crooked black tail snaked around the corner as the furry intruder escaped into the library nook, leaving a trail of wet tracks and the dust on the floor. Stumbling forward and collapsing against the bathroom entrance, I laughed, then gulped in air, then laughed, then gulped in air. Sometimes there really was a simple explanation. With the old lever-style faucets, it wasn't impossible that a cat could turn on the water. Just to prove it, I stepped into the room and batted the faucet with one finger, turning it partway off, on again, then all the way off. It had to be the cat. He was smart, like one of the animals on Letterman's stupid pet tricks. Bells jingled softly somewhere down the hall, playing a strange, sweet music against the silence. I followed the sound, expecting to find a black furball skulking among the bookshelves, but instead the library area was empty. At the end of the corridor, the door to the blue room stood ajar now. Not open, not closed, but halfway between. Music was coming from inside, the high, distinct notes drifting into the hallway as random and alluring as Luna moths flitting through space on a quiet summer night. The roots of my hair tingled, and a shiver convulsed my shoulders. I remembered the door falling out of my hand and slamming against the wall the day Iola died. The impact had rattled the entire second story. Even if the cat could operate doorknobs as well as water faucets, how could the door be resting quietly a foot or so from the wall? Maybe this was all some strange dream, and I'd wake up any minute laughing about it. Cats opening doors and using water faucets, really? Yet the feeling that something was waiting for me in that room was overwhelming. Not just waiting, but insisting that I come in. Inviting me, drawing me closer until I could see the slice of the room that the opening allowed. Under the turret window, the marble-top writing desk basked in the sunlight. There were birds on the windowsill again, two, a cardinal and a robin. They watched, but didn't flit away as I touched the door frame, craned sideways to see the foot of the bed. Part of me expected Iola to be there, looking perfectly at peace atop the wedding ring quilt in her blue flower basket dress. She wasn't, of course. In taking her away, the men had rumpled the quilt so that now it hung askew, even the impression of her body gone. Behind the door, one of Iola's black shoes sat perpendicular to the wall, the toe propping the door open. Someone must have kicked it during all the coming and going when she died. The other shoe was still sitting beside the bed, neatly placed, exactly where it had been the last time I'd seen it. It looked lonely now, slightly forlorn. The bells jingled again, and I swiveled so fast that I stumbled sideways and caught the cool crystal of the doorknob to steady myself. On one of the small walnut nightstands, the cat was walking in slow circles, arching to scratch its back against the scalloped edges of a Tiffany lampshade. Each time it passed the window, the shepherd's hook of its tail touched the fringes of a stained glass suncatcher with little brass bells dangling from the bottom. "So that's what you're doing," I pointed at the cat, pleased with myself for figuring out the secret. He looked at me, his head tilting slightly as if he were coyly smiling back. Despite our love-hate dance all morning, I almost felt sorry for him. The scars of a long and difficult life were evident up close. The old tomcat had been through more than a few scrapes. His look turned wary, and he quit circling in favor of keeping an eye on me. "You're just full of surprises," I told him as his tea-colored eyes studied me up and down. "I'll find out how you're getting into this place, you know. I'll figure out the answer sooner or later." He yawned in a way that said, "Go ahead and try, kitchen cleaning woman. You'll never discover my secrets." His eyes met mine for a moment before he jumped from the table and whisked underneath the bed, disappearing beneath the dust ruffle and a patchwork of blue wedding rings. Crossing between the bed and a closet doorway, I straightened the quilt. It seemed like Iola would want it that way. The suncatcher was beautiful up close, hummingbirds and passion vine. Patchy sunshine flickered through, spreading colored light over my outstretched fingertip as I swept it along the bottom of the three brass bells, listening to their music, then stopping to capture the one closest to the bed. There was a small gold sticker on the back. Turning the bell over, I cocked my head sideways to read the words. "Sandy's Seashell Shop, an ocean of possibilities." The sticker wasn't sun-dried or faded, and the green ribbon attached to the fringe window shade was still shiny and pliable. A tiny work of art hadn't been hanging here overly long. Apparently, even though Iola didn't leave her house, she still bought things somehow, at Sandy's Seashell Shop, wherever that was. The bell jingled as I let it fall into place again before finishing with the quilt, giving the room the picture-perfect, if dusty, look of the first time I'd seen it. I reached for the single black shoe behind the door, then thought better of it. No sense letting the knob crash against the wall repeatedly. The shoe almost seemed to belong there, as if Iola might have used the same trick herself. I wondered if she liked this room, with its sunny windows and frame prints of ladies in turn-of-the-century gowns, hiding their smiles coyly behind lace fans, sharing tea in a garden, greeting beaux dressed as huntsmen on horseback, playing croquet with smiling cherub-faced children. Over the bed, a majestic collie posed in lush green grass, overlooking a pastoral scene with sheep grazing on a hillside. Everything in this room spoke of a beautiful life, a perfect life. But in the back of my mind, there were the things the deputy had revealed. Her life hadn't been ideal. She'd been rejected by the good people of Fairhope. I knew exactly how that felt. Outside, the breeze caught a nest of pine branches, spilling a beam of unfiltered sun through the turret windows. The spray of glitter and ribbons on the sill danced in the glow, and I was there beside it before I even realized I'd moved. The curtain of light withdrew slowly, surrendering the old shoebox to shadow again as I leaned over it, took in a tangle of gold rickrack lying atop a pile of ribbon scraps and wallpaper shreds. Craft supplies had been weighted down with a bottle of Elmer's glue and a pair of scissors. The corner of a floral stationery sheet peeked from underneath the box, a few words in blue ink visible at the bottom of the page. "In our own time, your loving daughter, Iola Ann." The writing trembled uphill, the final E in Anne disintegrating into a curved line that slipped across the page and ran off the margin. The letter couldn't have been written very long ago. But your loving daughter? Iola had been in her 90s. There was no possible way her parents could still be alive. I slid the box back a hair, read the rest of the last line. "We are all warriors in our own time." What in the world? Maybe Iola had been confused, suffering from dementia, hopelessly trapped in the past and living in a world that didn't exist anymore. That might explain why she kept herself locked in this house and why some parts of it were in perfect order, while others were cluttered with 32 rolls of wax paper and food stacked to the ceiling. My skin tingled with the sense that someone was watching. It forced me to glance back to check, but the room was empty, of course. No one there to see me lift the box, slide the letter from beneath it, and begin to read. "Dearest Father, I thought there would be no more of these letters. It seems rather silly, doesn't it, that I would write to you when penny words require such effort now? These old hands, they don't tell stories as they once did, send words into the world with abandon, the lines bleeding forth as if there will forever be more words, more paper, another pen filled with ink in all the hues of life. How odd, isn't it? That in the end, life comes to surviving more than living. But these things I do, this melody of an ordinary day, keep the hours in order. I have lived my way into this music note by note, and now I know no other. Strange to think of that, the song of an ordinary life. Mine would be in these letters to you. A rain song, these months since the storm. A song of placing buckets and emptying buckets and placing, emptying, placing, emptying, placing, emptying. A melody of drip, drop, drip, drop, drip, drop. I suppose I should try again to have a carpenter come to fix the roof, but it seems too large a task. If they see the shape of things, I'll find myself in the county home, and then who will empty the buckets? But still, it is a wearisome task. You have left this big house in my charge for so long. I wonder if there may have been another way. I took time with the newspaper today, other than just to sop water with it. There was a boy on the front page in a photo. I knew him. He brings the groceries every week in the rusty blue truck that sounds like an ailing farm tractor coming up the drive. I write to you because of this boy. The newspaper told of families on Hatteras, struggling in the aftermath of the storm. The boy's father lost his employment when the bridge was out, and no commerce could come to the island. The father left to find work and never returned. Now there's only the boy, a mother, a little sister, a brother, and a grandfather. The boy's name is Jeremy. Sad to say that I have exchanged the payment for my grocery bill with him each week for 6 months now since the storm and never asked. He colors his hair an unnatural black and wears rings in both ears and one pinched in his nose, like the warriors in a photo from National Geographic. I suppose this is my reason for never having inquired. I've tucked $50 into an envelope and left it on the kitchen counter to remind myself.
Before he comes next, I will write his name on it and set it out with the bill. But I wonder if you might do something for him as well. My ways of helping are small, but your resources are boundless. I am left to ponder what else I could have done. Had I looked sooner, had I opened my door and seen not a boy, but a warrior with his fearsome hair and his rings of gold. I, more than most, should know that the most difficult battles are not the ones fought outside the armor, but the ones within it. Those, like Jeremy, will breathe life into these scraps of land cast among the sea. Theirs will be the task of repairing the damage wrought by the storm, rebuilding what lies in tatters. My time for fighting is running dry. I feel it. I pray that this boy might have strength for his battle, a warrior's strength. I pray also for the Mulberry girl. We are all warriors in our own time. Your loving daughter, Iola Ann.
Chapter 5. Bing's Village Market was quieter than usual. The midday air was warm and pleasant, the fishing boat still out. Old Man Bing looked up from the counter and squinted, trying to place me as I came in the door. Usually, if I had to go into Bing's, I tried to slip in when the place was busy so I wouldn't be noticed. But after a day and a half of scrubbing dirt and piling up trash at Iola's house, I needed more supplies, and I couldn't go over to Buxton to get them. I'd burned up a quarter tank of gas last night, driving around to see if I could track down Ross, so using more fuel for a shopping trip was out of the question. I hadn't even thought of picking up cleaning supplies while I was out, because my mind was on Ross. At this point, I was seriously nervous about the fact that he hadn't called back since he'd hung up on me and headed for Captain Jack's. If I hadn't been busy with Iola's house, I would have been in a complete panic by now.
Afternoon.
Bing rested his elbows on a counter covered with taped-on yard sale flyers, along with advertisements for lost dogs, live music, and free kittens. Hi. I hurried to the half-dozen aisles of groceries near the meat counter. The few times I'd stopped in before, the store smelled like fish and salt water, but today the air was a rich mix of spices, peanuts boiling in a crock pot of brine, and food frying on a griddle behind the meat counter. The scent reminded me of something, but I couldn't quite place it. The feeling was warm, though, soothing, like knowing that your favorite comfort food is cooking on the stove. Behind the counter, Bing's wife, Geneva, was tending the griddle. As I passed by, she waggled a gloved finger, sloppy with what looked like raw meat. "Try that sausage." I glanced over my shoulder, but there was no one else around. "See if it's good," she added again without looking at me. "It's always a guessing game, getting the mix right. If I ask Bing, he'll have it so hot it'll fry your noggin." I knew now why the aroma in Bing's was familiar today. It reminded me of Pap-Pap and Meemaw's house. I tasted one of Geneva Bing's sausage patties, and it was as good as it smelled. "It's wonderful," I told her. "Really good."
"Super. Go ahead and eat up the rest of it. Lord knows my rear end doesn't need it."
She gave the plate of sausage a backhanded wave. When I reached for another piece, she was watching me, though.
"You're little JT's mama, aren't you?"
The meat-covered finger wiggled again, and behind her glasses, hazel eyes lit with a look of interest that struck off a warning in my head. Apparently, JT had been hanging around town even more than I thought. He and Geneva Bing were well acquainted. "Tandy," I said, by way of not confirming or denying anything. Geneva seemed to like the sound of me.
"That boy of yours is something else. What a sweetheart. Stronger than he looks, too. He's been hauling my trash for me after he gets off the school bus every day. I imagine he told you that."
"Oh, sure." I tried not to seem completely dumb to the fact. Our first couple weeks in Iola's cottage, I'd been too sick to know what the kids were doing. Getting off painkillers isn't a smooth process. Since I'd met Ross, I'd been out with him or looking for a job so many afternoons that I wasn't sure what time JT was actually supposed to get home from the bus.
"He can clean out a donut case, too, I'll tell you."
Geneva laughed, her cheeks rounding into two plump red globes that pressed against her eyeglasses.
"I'm amazed at what he can eat. But that's kids. They're starving after school."
The sausage coagulated in the back of my mouth, and my throat went dry. I tried to swallow, but I couldn't. Now I knew why JT never complained about the lack of food in the cottage anymore.
"But But it works out, because by that time of day, I've got a lot of trash built up, and whatever's left in that donut case is history anyhow. Pretty fair trade, trash hauling for leftover donuts.
She turned away long enough to flip several sausage patties on the electric griddle, but kept right on talking.
Bet by now y'all are tired of all those donuts coming home, though. I asked him about that, and he said you didn't mind him having them.
I could feel blood creeping up my neck and washing into my cheeks. I forced the sausage down in one big gulp. Bing joined in the conversation from across the room.
He's been helping some of the guys wash decks and cull out junkfish on the dock, too. I think you've got a natural-born fisherman there. That boy's got a love of the water. Hung around here half the day a couple weeks ago Saturday, just working on the boats. Got himself a free lunch for it.
Oh, a couple of weeks ago Saturday, I'd been in Raleigh with Ross. We ate at a steakhouse and went dancing at a place he liked. JT was with Zoe, I thought. Did she tell him he could come down here? I'm glad he hasn't been any trouble, I choked out. Oh, no, ma'am, Geneva assured me. He's a cute little rascal. Bink nodded in agreement. I thought about leaving without even buying cleaning supplies for Iola's house. I just wanted to get out of here.
So, you're in the rental at Iola and Poole's place?
This time Geneva gave me more than a shoot-in-the-breeze look.
So sad that she passed away alone like she did. She'd been a good customer a long time.
Bink made a disgruntled noise under his breath and pushed off the counter, watching as a skiff motored to the dock out back.
I heard you found her, Geneva pressed. Poor old thing.
Bink spit air through his teeth and crossed his arms over his belly.
For heaven's sake, Bink, the woman laid there in the bed for who knows how long and passed away all alone.
Bink adjusted his cap lower and slouched over his belly bulge, turning his face away.
That's not very charitable.
A few visual daggers flew in Bink's direction.
There's history,
she whispered to me.
But some people need to get over it.
I glanced at my watch, deciding that a $3 roll of trash bags would do for now. I'd figure out the rest later. No way I was charging cleaning supplies on the church's bill here. I could just imagine the round of questions that would bring on. As much as Iola deserved to have someone defend her, I was not the one. If word got around that I was working in that house, these people would be all over me. Nice talking to you. I grabbed a box of trash bags off an end cap, then hurried to the front counter. Bink was in no rush to ring me up. It took him forever to slide off his stool.
Tell that young fella of yours, if he's around in the summer, once the rental places fill up on the island, there's work for him here.
He was all smiles again.
When the tourists move in, Jeremy can always use help filling orders and getting boxes packed for deliveries. Those people like their groceries waiting on the steps when they get to their cottages, don't they, Jeremy?
Bink nodded toward a teenager coming in the door. Tall, thin, with his hair dyed black. Two gold earrings and a gold nose ring glimmered in the sunlight.
Yeah,
Jeremy answered without really looking at either of us. His shoulders slumped, as if given the choice he wouldn't be noticed at all. The boy with the black hair. The one whose father had left the family after the storm. The envelope I was just about to reach for, the $50 I'd been trying to convince myself it'd be okay to keep because the kids and I needed it, was for him. I knew what it was like for a family when the father walked out. There were bills to pay, and no one to pay them. I opened my wallet and handed Bink the money for the trash bags. All I could think was, there goes a gallon of milk, 6 boxes of macaroni and cheese, a jar of peanut butter. But with the food I'd carried back to the cottage on my way to Bink's, we'd be okay for a while. I had the strangest urge to touch Jeremy's arm as he slipped by, quiet and dark like Iola's house cat. I wanted to look into him and say, I know it's hard, but hang in there. I hope your father wakes up one day and sees how much a kid needs his daddy. And when your high school English teacher says you're smart enough to really do something with your life, listen to her, okay? I didn't tell him any of that, of course. One thing I'd learned growing up was to mind my business and let other people mind theirs. But for some reason, today, as I passed by Jeremy's vehicle out front, it seemed right to slip that envelope from my back pocket and drop it onto the seat of the rusted-out truck that Iola had described in her letter. Maybe that money would do whatever she hoped it would do. Maybe, if she was watching right now, She'd be happy that her envelope had been delivered after all. I felt good as I started across the parking lot, like the day was worth it, beyond just putting food in our bellies and keeping a roof over our heads, beyond just surviving. I pictured Jeremy finding that envelope, opening the flap, looking around, and wondering if an angel had dropped it into his car. Maybe an angel had. I guessed I had Iola and her crazy old house to thank for that. It's not every day you get to be someone's angel. A smile pulled from deep inside me for the first time in recent memory. The real kind of smile. Not the kind you paste on to keep up a front. The sky was clear, just the barest upsweeps of white clouds rising over the Sound. Head and Scrat, Pap-Pap had called them. Head and Scrat and Philly's tails make lofty ships carry low sails. I remembered that now. He'd pointed out the wispy low-hanging clouds to me all those years ago when we were here on Hatteras. I could feel his whiskery chin on my hair as he leaned down and stretched an arm over my shoulder, aiming a finger and tracing the contour of the vapor in the sky.
When they come in early in the day like that, it means there's wind and weather ahead. The hens are scratching up little dust puffs in the sky, and the fillies are on the run so their tails are long, see? My granddad used to tell us that on the shrimp boat.
I saw the hen scratches and fillies' tails then, and I thought of the wild Spanish mustangs that still ran free up north in Corolla, their tails trailing behind them as they bolted down the beach. I imagined my grandfather on a shrimp boat with my great-great-grandfather, who knew the sea and lived by it. They're pretty, I said. I thought Pap-Pap would like that, and he did.
Yes, they are, Tandy Joe.
He stood beside me then, bracing his hands on his overalls, smiling at the sky and watching the clouds. I felt like I was pretty, too, like I was special because Pap-Pap took the time to teach me things.
Looks like you're having a good day.
The voice caught me by surprise, and I glanced down to see the guy who mowed the lawn at Iola's house. He was walking from Mosey Creek with mason jars full of murky water sloshing in each hand. Paul. The last name wasn't coming to me right off. Something Chastain, maybe. A boat passed by in the marina behind Banks, the motor vibrating the air, so I didn't feel the need to come up with something to say until the sound had died. By then, Paul was at the edge of the parking lot with his jars of water. He lifted one so I could get a better look.
Science class, he explained. I teach part-time at the school and do contract work for the park service in the afternoons.
He set the jars on the tailgate of his pickup. He had a kayak instead of lawn mowing equipment in the back this time.
A few drops of that stuff, you'll find all kinds of things to look at under a microscope. Bacteria, viruses, protists. Things that fundamentally influence the ocean's ability to sustain life.
Well, when you put it that way, it looks like more than just dirty water. I flashed a smile and then wished I hadn't. I didn't want him to think I was coming on to him. With the divorce papers left behind for Trammell and Ross in my life now, I wasn't looking for any complications. Aside from that, a guy wearing camp shorts and a shirt covered with flamingos playing jazz instruments doesn't exactly scream sexy. Still, I felt so good today I couldn't contain it. I felt clear-headed and like I'd done something really right for once. He quirked an eyebrow underneath his floppy fishing hat, as if he wondered what I was thinking, then adjusted the stampede string that ran through a wooden bead under his chin.
Dirty water doesn't get enough respect.
It's good that it has you to defend it, then. I laughed as he turned to put the lids on the jars, his long, thin fingers twirling the rings into place with surprising finesse. The man could handle a mason jar. Maybe that came with the territory, science teaching.
I didn't realize you were JT's mom the other day until I saw the kids drive up in Rowdy's Jeep.
Setting the jars in a crate stuffed with hay, he hooked a leg over a corner of the tailgate. A flip-flop dangled loosely from his foot as he threaded his hands together and rested them like we were going to have a sit and whittle together.
I have JT in class. He told me you were living in a rented place, but he didn't say where. He doesn't talk much.
Guilt needled, poking little holes in my blue sky day, letting in the gray behind the paper-thin good feeling. There was a time when JT was such a chatterbox, I'd send him to the store with Trammell's housekeeper just so I could pop a pill and sleep the day away. I wasn't even sure when the surgery pain stopped, or when JT changed, or when the pills became a mechanism for dulling a different kind of pain. That was the worst part of it. I just woke up from the haze one day and realized I'd been elbowing the kids away for so long I didn't even know who they were or who I was. He's in a phase, I told Paul. What else can you do but make an excuse when you can't tell the truth?
He does his work,
Paul said, and I was relieved. I was afraid he would ask me to explain JT, and I couldn't.
While he's back there drawing Dragon Slayers and Pokemons, or whatever those things are he doodles in the margins of his papers, he is getting the material.
He's into Zygo Wars. That much I did know.
Has some interest in oceanography, too,
Paul offered.
He was down here the other day when I was cast netting, and he had quite a few questions about the things I pulled out of the water. That's more words than I've gotten out of him in a month and a half of class.
Oh, well, that's good.
There's a summer camp for kids who want to work with the sea turtle nests. They help monitor the sites, keep track of the incubation days, maintain spreadsheets, watch for depressions in the sand that might indicate a nest is getting ready to hatch. If they're lucky, they get to be there for a hatching or two, count hatchlings, chase the foxes away, and that kind of thing. Might be something he'd enjoy. You never know what will ignite an interest in a kid. I could send some information home with them, if you like.
Sure. Okay. I wasn't used to teachers coming to me about the kids, bad or good. Usually, Zoe kept the lid on things for both her and JT, so there wasn't any need for teachers to call home. Zoe's excuses were nothing new. I'd used them all myself, years ago. Oh, my mom has to work. She's out of town. She said to tell you she's sorry she missed open house night. She's down in the bed. Her back gives her trouble. It crossed my mind that this was a new place, a new start. Things didn't have to be the way they were before. I wanted the kids to have a home life they didn't have to hide from everyone. I wanted to know what they were doing in school. That'd be nice, thank you. Then I was sorry I said yes. What if JT got all excited about some summer camp? I couldn't pay for that kind of thing. You know, on second thought, it might be better if you didn't. I'm not sure where we'll be by summer. I hate to get his hopes up. Sooner or later, something would happen with Iola's place, and we'd have to move out. I'd be lucky if kids could even finish the school year here on Hatteras, much less be around for summer camp. It hit me full force now, how much of this plan of mine depended on luck. I was making promises I probably couldn't keep. I'd told the kids we were staying here. This was it, our new place. The science teacher's brown eyes studied me, narrowing. He had nice eyes, a warm honey tea color, framed with lashes that were surprisingly dark for someone with a red-headed complexion.
The opposite of getting your hopes up is not harboring any,
he said softly, and I had the uncomfortable sense that he'd read my mind. For a moment, I couldn't do anything but look into his eyes and wonder how much he knew. A white bucket in the back of his truck rattled on its own, and I jumped.
The prisoners.
Winking sideways at me, he nodded toward the bucket, offering me a look. My curiosity was piqued, and aside from that, I was glad to be off the topic of hopes and summer camp. What have you got in there?
Take a gander.
Reaching into the bed of the truck, he hooked his fingers over the edge of the bucket and dragged it closer, but I couldn't see the bottom. I inched in, leaning over my crossed arms, the grocery bag dangling against my elbow. I caught the faint scent of sand and seawater. Paul shook the bucket a little, and something squirmed inside. I jerked back again, and he chuckled. I knew he was messing with me. Hold it still, I squealed.
What?
He sounded like a little boy in the schoolyard hiding something in his fists and saying, Bet you can't guess what I've got behind my back.
You don't trust me.
Depends on what's in that bucket. If that's a snake or something, I'm out of here. You live in Texas a while, you learn to hate snakes with a passion. The first time you step out the door and find a rattlesnake, sonny, you're cured of the good snake, bad snake myth.
No, ma'am. This was dinner.
Well, that leaves out snakes, I guess. I set the grocery bag on the tailgate, and the two of us leaned closer, our shoulders brushing.
Not necessarily.
He joked, finally tipping the bucket far enough that I could see crabs in the bottom, four of them. Oh, man. I breathed. I remembered going crabbing with Pap-Pap and Meemaw. We helped Pap-Pap tie chicken necks to lengths of twine, then tossed the bait in the cove and drove little metal stakes into the ground. Gina and I built drip castles on shore and chased ghost crabs while we waited. There was a small hoop-shaped crab net lying in the bed of Paul's truck. I reached for it without even thinking to ask. My Pap-Pap had one of these. We used to drive down a road someplace around Kill Devil Hills. I can't remember exactly where that was. An image flashed through my mind. Pap-Pap's weathered, sun-spotted hands, pushing bait into a green mesh bag and tying it in the center of the homemade net. "But they'll just climb out," I'd protested, and he'd smiled at me.
"You watch, sis."
I remembered his face now, every detail of it. Over the years, I'd let it go, let him go, and Meemaw. It was too painful to remember how good those times were, how peaceful and sweet. How much I wanted Pap-Pap and Meemaw to be able to keep Gina and me forever. How angry I was when Mama made sure they couldn't. I can't remember how it works. I was talking to myself more than Paul now, the whisper a drift of breeze from the past. Paul let the bucket rest.
"And here I had you pegged for a landlubber."
His finger settled over mine, and he moved one of my hands to the center of the net, then gripped the lines on either side of the rim.
"Like this."
He pulled, and the frame bent at the hinges, folding into a half-moon shape, trapping my hand inside, the metal closing loosely over my wrist.
"There, you're caught."
A truck turned into the parking lot, the rumble of the diesel engine echoing off the weathered wood and concrete block of Bink's store. Something in the sound of it, the grinding of the knobby tires or the soft groan of the leaf spring, caught my attention, plucking a familiar thread. I looked up, and I knew who it was even before the shadow of Bink's roadside sign blocked out the glare that hid the driver. Ross. Chapter 6. I jerked away quickly enough that the crab trap tightened around my wrist, the salt-encrusted edges leaving red marks on my skin as the lines pulled taut in Paul's hands.
"Whoa, hey, hang on a minute,"
he chuckled, grabbing the metal rim to open it.
"There you go. Relax, I wasn't going to toss you into the dinner bucket with the captives, I promise."
"Sorry." I stepped backward, putting distance between Paul and me. I could feel Ross watching as his truck crossed the parking lot, but I didn't turn to look. I didn't want to seem like I'd been caught at something. "I hope I didn't break it." Paul bent to wrap the lines around the net, his face disappearing beneath the fishing hat.
"Nah, this whole thing's tougher than that. I found it with some of my granddad's fishing rods when I moved back here to look after Gran. It's been around the block a few times."
I had the feeling he was talking about more than just the net, but I didn't have time to wonder. I could hear Ross getting out of his truck. Inside, a part of me cringed as the door slammed shut. I felt like I'd been doing something wrong, and now I'd pay for it. Old habit. Not that Ross had ever treated me that way, but there was a couple of times when guys got friendly on the beach, and Ross had already let me know he didn't like it. He thought I was doing something to bring it on.
"You're pretty, Tandy. You look at a guy, and he's gonna look back."
When he said things like that, I soaked it up as a compliment. Everywhere we went, women from 17 to 60 checked Ross out. Chicks he knew smiled and hugged him when we went into surf shops and restaurants and whatnot. He could have pretty much any girl he wanted, and he wanted me. Paul was completely oblivious to the change in the air around us. He whistled the theme from Jeopardy, his head bobbing back and forth as he shook out the tangles in the lines and wound them around the net. "Well, thanks for telling me about JT," I said loudly enough that Ross could hear every word as he approached. "What was he doing here anyway? Had his friends at Captain Jack's told him I'd come looking for him last night?" "I'm glad JT's doing so well in science." Paul quirked a brow at me, probably wondering if I thought he was deaf all of a sudden. He didn't know we had company until Ross was right there on top of us. Ross didn't say anything. He just stopped and stood with his hands on his hips, his fingers spreading into his jeans pockets, the muscles in his arms flexing around the hem of a short-sleeved western shirt that fit just right. He looked like a dog bristling when another dog comes sniffing around.
"What's going on, Tandy?"
"Hey, Ross." I blinked at him like I hadn't noticed him driving in. "Where'd you come from? I figured you were still crashed out after your last trip."
"Yeah, I can see that."
His jaw tightened, and he nodded toward Paul, making it clear that there would be no polite introductions, and he wanted Paul to exit the scene. Paul looked from me to Ross and back, his forehead wrinkling against the dorky hat, the leather stampede strain catching on his ear, and hanging cockeyed beside his mouth so that he looked like Gilligan. If Ross was the mad pit bull in this stare-down, Paul was the clueless Labrador retriever with no idea that he was about 6 inches from a bad situation. "Thanks again for telling me about JT," I repeated, then snagged my grocery sack off the tailgate.
"Sure, anytime. He's a good student. Whenever I see him drawing those things he draws, I'll know it's Zygo Wars, not Pokemon.
Paul grinned amiably.
No wonder he's been giving me the lame-o look every time I say that.
That's good. Well, have a great afternoon. I reached for Ross, intending to catch his arm and turn him toward his own vehicle. I could feel the testosterone radiating in the air like steam off a boiler.
This is the guy that was at your house when I called the other night.
Ross